company in particular has been criticized by international organizations for its lack of transparency and claims of corruption. According to the corporate monitor Transparency International, the Wansheng Group is one of the least transparent companies on the planet. In 2016, the international organization did an evaluation of 100 companies in emerging markets, including India, Brazil, Russia, Mexico, and China. They evaluated each company for their transparency as well as the presence of anti-corruption policies. Only 3 companies received a 0 on a scale of 0 to 100. Wansheng was one of them. The other 2 were also Chinese companies. Transparency International noted in a press release, "The very weak Chinese results stem from weak or non-existent anti-corruption policies and procedures, or a clear failure to disclose them in line with international practice." Part of the problem was that the companies from China, including Wansheng, disclosed little or no financial data, the report said. Another reporter analyzing the report was more straightforward. "These enterprises did not practice any form of transparency and can be assumed as most corrupt." Because of its tight relationship with the ruling government in Beijing and its close ties with powerful political friends in the United States, Wansheng has operated even in North Korea with the support of the Chinese premier while also evading U.S. sanctions. Those close ties with American politicians likely also explain how Wansheng got Washington approval to acquire advanced U.S. technology, even though many warned that the deal severely damaged U.S. national security. In 2009, newly elected President Obama launched a federal stimulus program that was designed to get the U.S. economy moving again. The administration pushed forward a $787 billion spending plan, including infrastructure projects. Obama, a big believer in the value of alternative energy, made pouring taxpayer money into green energy companies an important component of the stimulus plan. Billions of taxpayer dollars went to wind companies, solar panel manufacturers, and biofuels. Money was also directed at companies trying to produce electric cars and new battery technologies. One major recipient was a Massachusetts-based battery company called A123. Founded in 2001, the company was developing new batteries based on small nanoscale materials that had been originally developed at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The company was approved for a $249 million grant from the Department of Energy's Electric Drive Vehicle Battery and Component Manufacturing Initiative project. The company used the money to build 2 battery plants in Michigan. In September 2010, President Obama called the Livonia, Michigan plant when it opened. "This is about the birth of an entire new industry in America, an industry that's going to be central to the next generation of cars," he told the assembled workers by phone. "The work you're doing will help power the American economy for years to come." It did not. The highly subsidized company struggled. Much of its business was supposed to come from electric car manufacturer Fisker, which was trying to produce fully electric cars. Fisker had been championed by the Obama administration, which gave $529 million in taxpayer loans into the company. Vice President Joe Biden publicly announced the investment of U.S. taxpayer dollars at a high-profile ceremony in Delaware. Rosemont Seneca, run in part by Hunter Biden and Christopher Hines, owned a stake of the company. So did then-Senator John Kerry via Rosemont. According to financial disclosures, Kerry's share could be valued up to $1 million. But sales were slow. By early 2012, A123 was in financial trouble. In August, Wansheng offered to step in and buy 80% of the company. By October, the company had declared bankruptcy. With A123 in bankruptcy, an auction was organized by the bankruptcy court. Wansheng was bidding against Milwaukee-based Johnson Controls, a leader in mechanical and engineering systems. Wansheng won the bid. Wansheng's offer to purchase A123 set off alarm bells in the industry and Washington, D.C. A123 possessed industry-leading technologies that had applications not only for civilian uses, but also for advanced military systems, including satellites. A123 even had a few small military contracts. As former White House Deputy National Security Advisor Mark Fifley put it, "In the world of advanced lithium-ion batteries, The Holy Grail has been the development of safer, faster recycling and longer-lasting technology that will operate in extreme temperatures. A123 had developed such a technology in partnership with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, noted Fifley. Their technology advances battery science by at least a decade. He warned that if the sale to Wenshang was not stopped, the United States may soon have to depend on one of China's wealthiest and most politically connected Communist Party leaders for access to taxpayer-funded technology that will power the next generation of space satellites and unmanned military vehicles. A bipartisan group of U.S. senators, including Democrats Dick Durbin and Debbie Stabenow, as well as Republicans John Thune and Chuck Grassley, wrote letters to senior Obama administration officials, members of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, or CFIUS, asking them to block Wenshang's acquisition of A123. The transfer of assets, technology, and intellectual property developed with American tax dollars to a foreign company would be irresponsible, read one letter. A federal body created in 1975, CFIUS is required to review all foreign purchases of American companies and approve or disapprove each purchase based on strategic or technological implications for America's national security. Over the years, CFIUS has reviewed energy companies, technology companies, telecoms, and military contractors. The fact was, Wenshang was already closely linked to the White House. Lu Guangqi had visited the Obama White House twice for meetings. Wenshang had a solar energy facility that was receiving federal government grants and loans. Former Chicago Mayor Richard Daley was already on the Wenshang payroll, too, and he extolled the company's virtues. Wenshang has shown itself a strong corporate citizen with a commitment to supporting local workers and developing the local economy, Daley told the Boston Globe. Daley was in regular contact with his brother and other senior White House officials, too. Eventually, Wei Di Lu, the daughter of Wenshang's founder, gave $33,400 to the Democratic National Committee on May 21, 2015, according to Federal Election Commission records. Her husband, Pin Ni, who heads up Wenshang America, also gave $33,400 on the same day. Wenshang tried to paint itself as a company independent of the Chinese government, ignoring the fact that the chairman of the company was part of the Chinese government. Many observers saw it otherwise. As Canada's Financial Post put it, Wenshang is a state-backed enterprise, receiving low-rate loans from the Chinese government to help it expand abroad. In addition to security concerns, the economic concern was that the company would export A123's technology to China and reduce or end manufacturing in the United States. Wenshang and its allies allayed this concern by saying that they were not going to take the technology to China and intended to keep the technology right here in the United States. The obvious national security issues could not be ignored, so Wenshang tried to sidestep those concerns by focusing on A123's military contracts. It claimed no interest in them, and they eventually went to a small Michigan-based defense contractor named Navitas Systems. But as Fifley points out, this arrangement was ridiculous on its face. Under the terms of the bankruptcy sale, the Chinese would not have access to A123 Systems' existing military contracts, but that should be of little comfort. It is the technology, the company's trade secrets and patents, that should be of concern, not its defense contracts. In fact, the company bidding for the military contracts paid only $3 million for them compared to Wenshang's bid of $250 million for the remainder. Jeffrey Green, executive director of the Strategic Minerals Advisory Council, declared that the arrangement was a technical fiction. Navitas Systems would not own or control any of the technology. Every bit of that, process, equipment, and technology would be owned by the Chinese. That's the fiction. Wenshang's acquisition of A123 created legal problems because the technology in question fell under U.S. arms export laws, and the United States had an ongoing embargo against China. As the 8 U.S. senators noted in their letter, not only are these products subject to U.S. export laws, but the company's research is also subject to the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, or ITAR, which prohibits its dissemination to restricted foreign parties. In the end, Wanxiang's acquisition of A123 sailed through the Obama administration and won approval, with no conditions placed on the sale. It was an audacious victory. Despite these noises from Congress, CFIUS promptly approved the acquisition in January 2013 with no refilings, no mitigations, and no special security arrangements, as the Peterson Institute for International Economics put it. The decision incensed many senior national security officials and former military officers. The Strategic Minerals Advisory Council, which is comprised of former U.S. senior national security and military officials, denounced the decision. By approving the deal, they lamented, the Obama administration just allowed China to leapfrog the world in advanced batteries at the expense of American taxpayers. They went on, the Chinese will now have direct access to U.S.-funded and developed technology that powers our military satellites and military drones and supports our soldiers in the field. The Council also rejected the platitude that Wanxiang would not share the sensitive technology with the Chinese government. Members of the senior executive team at Wanxiang Corporation have been members of the Chinese Communist Party for decades and must be approved by the Politburo. Allowing this transaction will give the Chinese government direct access to the most cutting-edge power technology or future satellite, power grid, and missile systems. Within the next year, by 2014, the Chinese government's China Daily was reporting that the technology and manufacturing were heading for China. The battery, designed and developed initially by A123, is expected to be launched in a brand new Hangzhou, China facility that is integrated as part of Wanxiang's acquisition. The Detroit Free Press reported afterward that A123 was undergoing a consolidation of its Michigan manufacturing facilities. 200 manufacturing jobs were cut, roughly a third of the company's workforce in Michigan. In December 2013, Wanxiang bid to purchase electric car manufacturer Fisker Automotive. Despite massive government-backed loans, the company was in bankruptcy and had an interesting list of creditors and investors. As we saw earlier, major investors included Rosemont Seneca Technology Partners. Biden, Hines, and Archer were also listed as personal creditors in the bankruptcy filings. In July 2014, Wanxiang founder Liu Guanqi arrived in the United States at the invitation of Joe Biden and met with him in Washington, D.C. 3 days after Liu toured the Fisker facility in Delaware, their purchase of the company was approved. Wanxiang's web of relationships with the political elite may also explain how the company avoids U.S. sanctions despite their commercial activities in North Korea, when even smaller companies have faced actions by Washington. North Korea, sometimes called the Hermit Kingdom, has been ruled for decades by the Kim family. Kim Il-sung ruled the country from 1948 until his death in 1994. His son, Kim Jong-il, was supreme leader from 1994 to 2011. Kim Jong-un took the helm after his father's death in December 2011. The country, whose rulers are all brutal, all megalomaniacs, is infamous for the worst human rights conditions on the planet, abject poverty, and extreme corruption. Doing business in such a country is tough, and because of the totalitarian nature of the country, you only do business there with the approval of the supreme leader himself. In 2007, Wanxiang set up a joint venture with the North Korean government to mine for copper in the country's desolate Ryanggang province. The Haesan Youth Copper Mine, one of the largest in North Korea, is located in the Paektu Mountains on the border with China. One can only wonder why youth is in the mine's name. According to the Korean Institute at Johns Hopkins University, Wanxiang's deal involved the Korea Mining Development Trading Corporation, or COMID. According to the U.S. Treasury Department, COMID was North Korea's primary arms dealer and main exporter of goods and equipment related to ballistic missiles and conventional weapons. In April 2009, COMID was put on the UN sanctions list, which meant that Wanxiang could not do the joint venture with them. So Wanxiang sealed the deal instead with the Ministry of Mining Industries of North Korea, taking a 51% stake. The deal was straightforward. Wenshang would provide the capital investment to upgrade production at the mine. North Korea would provide the labor. Copper would be exported to China. Both parties found the deal attractive. Upgrading and maintaining production would be cheap because pay in North Korea is one-fifth that of South Korea and a quarter of salaries paid in China. At the same time, the quality of the mine was among the best in Asia. The Heisan Youth Copper Mine had a grade of copper ore that is double that of Northeast China. The working conditions in the mine are brutal, even by North Korean standards. In 2010, it was reported that North Korean soldiers were sent to work at Heisan by Kim Jong-il. Work conditions were so harsh that the soldiers fled and went into hiding. Wenshang poured some $23 million into modernizing and upgrading the mine, which reportedly produces 50,000 to 70,000 tons of copper concentrate a year. Modernization of the mine was completed in 2011. Wenshang's actions in North Korea were not hidden from its friends and supporters back in the United States. Indeed, the company's English-language website reports on its milestones at the mine. The fact that Wenshang was doing business in North Korea was not a secret in Washington. The U.S. State Department was aware of the deal and reported on it in official cables. The U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations issued a report in 2012 on China's involvement in North Korea and noted both the existence and the importance of the mine. The U.S. Geological Survey, in its 2012 Minerals Yearbook, North Korea, even noted Wenshang's ownership of the Heisan mine. Wenshang faced some challenges. In 2009, the North Korean government tried to expropriate the mine after Wenshang had poured money into upgrading it. Wenshang saved the deal by making use of its close ties to Beijing. Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao himself intervened and pressured the North Koreans on behalf of the company. The deal remained intact. Lu Guangju defended doing business in North Korea on the grounds that the country will become more liberal as a result of its interaction with Chinese companies. Through our contact, we are certain they will become more open and more liberated, he said back in 2012. There is, of course, no evidence of this happening in North Korea. But there was one possible problem on the horizon in Washington. By 2016, another threat emerged to Wenshang's venture. The United Nations passed a resolution in March and strengthened it in November, calling for sanctions against trade with North Korea, including a prohibition on the export of non-ferrous metals such as copper. Also in 2016, President Barack Obama followed suit when he issued an executive order declaring that companies were not allowed to operate in any industry in the North Korean economy, including transportation, mining, energy, or financial services. Companies and individuals would face sanctions if they were found to have sold, supplied, transferred, or purchased anything from North Korea, including metal, including, of course, copper. One would expect big trouble for Wenshang. The Korea Herald reported, "The copper embargo is expected to deal a blow not only to Pyongyang, but also some Chinese mining companies. An affiliate with China's Wenshang Group has reportedly invested more than 28 billion yuan, or $23.8 million, in developing copper mines in the North Korean border town of Heisan since it acquired exclusive mineral rights through a joint venture in 2007. Wenshang might be operating the largest mine in North Korea, but the Obama administration went after other Chinese companies instead, including the Hongsheng Group. The Department of Justice charged four Chinese nationals and a trading company based in Dandong, China, with conspiring to evade U.S. economic sanctions on North Korea by using a front company to hide financial transactions with a North Korean bank. While there is nothing to suggest that Wenshang was involved in a similar financial scheme, the move still mystified those who were watching Chinese activity in North Korea, because those who were being prosecuted were far less involved in mining in North Korea than Wenshang. Radio Free Asia, a news organization funded by the U.S. federal government, noted that the Wenshang Group is the largest importer of North Korean mineral resources, not the Hongsheng Group, which is under investigation for illegal trading with the North. They reported that Hongsheng's imports of North Korean minerals were only a fraction of Wenshang's imports from the North. The resulting sanctions on competitors, of course, made things better for Wenshang in North Korea. As one source told United Press International, an investigation into companies doing business with North Korea should capture many large Chinese firms. The sanctions have actually given more benefits to Chinese companies. The source claimed that China feigns compliance with sanctions and the suspension of mineral imports, but Chinese companies have been acquiring North Korea's raw materials on a massive scale. Who benefits? For one, China's Wanshang Group, which holds an exclusive importation contract, valid until 2026, with North Korea's Haesan Youth Copper Mine, and is jointly operating the Haejung Mining Joint Venture Company with North Korea, which purchases all of the mineral resources in North Korea's Yeongang or Ryeonggang province. Princeling-style corruption helps to make American politicians and their families wealthy, while foreign governments and companies get powerful favors in Washington. American laws and regulations can be bent to suit the needs of foreign entities. This is one way that politicians use the power with which we entrust them to build their family empires. Another relatively new form of power abuse involves political smash and grab. 9. Barack Obama's best friend. Barack Obama went after certain industries in the name of the public good, while his best friend positioned himself to profit. Barack Obama's best friend became the go-to guy when companies faced regulatory threats from the Obama administration. Ronald and Nancy Reagan hobnobbed with Hollywood. Bill and Hillary Clinton had the Arkansas gang. George W. Bush hung out with his pals from Midland, Texas. Each American president brings a unique flair to the White House based on their circle of friends. For Barack Obama, that circle included a tight core of young professionals from Chicago. Over the course of more than a decade, they played basketball, raised children, built careers, and vacationed together. In 2008, when Barack Obama was elected president, some of those friends did Washington with the Obamas, too. An Associated Press writer described this small circle of friends as regulars at President Barack Obama's side, tagging along when he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in Norway, buying shave ice during the president's Hawaii vacation, shooting hoops in Washington, climbing a lighthouse on Martha's Vineyard off the Massachusetts coast, and attending A-list White House parties. While President Obama was making landmark decisions that adversely affected major American industries, his close friends were making seemingly well-timed financial bets in the wake of those decisions. Executive decisions by President Obama often caused thousands to lose their jobs and tens of thousands to have their lives disrupted. Those disruptions turned out to be financial opportunities for Obama's close friends who were positioned to profit from that political power. Call it smash and grab. Barack Obama's Chicago Circle was a collection of young African-American professionals, some of whom are well-known, such as Valerie Jarrett, who joined him in the White House. But many others are little known to the American public. Highly educated and motivated peers, they gravitated to the worlds of both politics and finance, which so easily intertwine. One of Obama's best friends is Marty Nesbitt, often referred to by mutual friends of both men as FOB number one, or as the Chicago Tribune calls him, the first friend. Nesbitt first entered the Obama circle back in 1980 when he was recruited to play basketball at Princeton University. Already on the team was Michelle Obama's brother, Craig Robinson. After Princeton, Nesbitt moved to Chicago for business school where he met Barack playing pickup basketball games. As Obama pursued his career in law and then in politics, Nesbitt went into business and enjoyed the financial backing of a powerful benefactor, Penny Pritzker, heir to the Hyatt Hotel fortune and a member of one of the most powerful political families in Chicago. Together, Nesbitt and Pritzker created a company called The Parking Spot, an off-site parking garage business with nearly 40 facilities. Penny Pritzker would go on to also play a major role in Barack Obama's political rise. How close are Barack Obama and Marty Nesbitt? When Obama ran for the U.S. Congress in 2000 against Congressman Bobby Rush, he tapped Marty Nesbitt to be his campaign chairman. Obama lost. When Obama ran for the state Senate, Nesbitt was a key fundraiser. When he ran for the U.S. Senate, Nesbitt was again on the Finance Committee. When Obama ran for president in 2008, he served as the campaign's treasurer. Barack Obama is the godfather to Nesbitt's son, and Nesbitt's wife, a physician, delivered the Obamas' two daughters. Along the way, they have taken vacations together and played golf and countless games of basketball. Once Barack Obama became president, Nesbitt was a regular presence at the White House. When the Obamas vacationed in Hawaii or in Martha's Vineyard, the Nesbitts were always there. Marty Nesbitt attended state dinners and barbecues on the White House South Lawn. They were in regular contact. In 2014, when Barack Obama was contemplating life after the White House, he asked Marty Nesbitt to serve as the chairman of the Obama Foundation. During Obama's tenure in office, Nesbitt had the direct access to the president that you might expect of an intimate friend. As he explained in one interview, "I don't have to call to schedule a time during the workday to talk to him, because I'll be like, I'm going to be here this weekend, we're going to go play golf, then I'll have time to run a couple of things by you." Nesbitt described their relationship this way to the Washington Post. "Every now and then, someone will send me on a mission because he needs to be told something that only I can tell him," Nesbitt said. "I'll say, hey, you know, they think you should be doing this." And Obama will respond, "You are just so transparent," Nesbitt added. "When he knows we're just trying to cheer him up or pump him up, he'll just start laughing." In early 2013, as Barack Obama was celebrating his re-election, Marty Nesbitt was preparing to launch a new venture, a private equity investment firm called Vistria. The word is a combination of the Latin words power and three. Nesbitt was launching the firm with another former basketball player named Harold Kip Kirkpatrick III. Kirkpatrick had run for state treasurer in Illinois and was well-connected in the Obama network. Kirkpatrick was also helping to build a company called United Shore Financial Services, formerly Shore Mortgage. At Shore, Kirkpatrick left the nuts and bolts of running the company to others and spent much of his time in Washington calling on politicians or meeting with executives from the federal government-backed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the folks who buy the loans that his company originated. Vistria was launched with money from Penny Pritzker, partly through an entity called the Pritzker-Traubert Family Foundation. They also secured funds from state government employee pension funds, including the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund and the New York State Retirement Fund. In both instances, these state retirement funds advanced the money through programs designed to boost investment business with minority-controlled investment funds. The investment business model at Vistria was unusual. While many investment funds shy away from investment deals involving highly regulated industries because of the red tape, Vistria was actually focused on those sectors. As Marty Nesbitt told his alumni magazine, "We will look to acquiring companies that are highly regulated. That kind of search leads to sectors such as education, healthcare, and financial services." On another occasion, he described Vistria's focus on companies that are at the nexus of the public and private sectors. Investing in highly regulated industries made sense, given that Nesbitt was best friends with the regulator-in-chief. An investment fund website noted about Vistria, "Both Nesbitt and Kirkpatrick are longtime politicos in Illinois, and they are targeting companies operating in highly regulated industries like education, healthcare, and financial services that will benefit from their expertise and presumably their connections." Marty Nesbitt launched Vistria in sync with his friend President Obama's re-election. According to corporate records, Nesbitt filed for a trademark on the name Vistria on December 11, 2012, just a month after his friend was re-elected. 10 days later, he was off for the annual Christmas vacation to Hawaii that his family took together with the Obamas. From December 21st to January 5th, 2013, they golfed, dined, and walked on the beach together. In the month Vistria became public on March 30th, 2013, Nesbitt attended an NCAA basketball tournament game with Obama. To help Vistria invest in highly regulated sectors, Nesbitt and Kirkpatrick brought on board several regulators and insiders from Obama's administration. One was Tony Miller, who had been appointed in July 2009 Deputy Secretary of Education in the Obama administration, and had played a central role in the development of a wide array of policies and regulations at the DOE. Miller left the DOE in July 2013 to join Vistria shortly after it opened its doors. During this time, Nesbitt and Obama remained close. They golfed together at Andrews Air Force Base and then stayed together at Camp David on August 3rd and 4th, 2013. Another early hire was John Samuels, who was the Deputy Assistant to President Obama for Legislative Affairs. On his LinkedIn page, Samuels describes his regulatory work in the Obama White House: strong focus on Dodd-Frank legislation, significant work to pass the Affordable Care Act. Also on his LinkedIn page, Samuels says of his duties at Vistria: private equity, public/regulatory policy, government relations, business development, strategy. Fortune magazine noted Samuels' hiring and the fact that he doesn't appear to have any experience working in the financial services industry. Rather, Samuels has made his career in politics. The industries that Vistria targeted to buy were the same industries that Nesbitt's friend, President Obama, was targeting with a series of government actions. Vistria's new hires, Miller and Samuels, had been instrumental in these massive government actions, which included everything from new regulations, legal actions, and legislative threats. A curious pattern began to emerge. Obama and his administration would attack industries with government power, which led to substantially lower valuations for these companies. Nesbitt and Vistria, or others close to Obama, could then acquire those assets for pennies on the dollar. The Obama administration had several industries in their crosshairs, deeming them destructive to the environment or exploitative of people. Industries such as coal mining, offshore energy companies, cash advance companies, and for-profit colleges became targets for litigation, regulatory squeeze, or denial of access to government services or funds. A circle of investors, including Vistria and others linked to Obama, would consistently purchase companies in these sectors once their valuations dropped under the government onslaught. One of the Obama administration's earliest and most visible targets was the for-profit higher education industry. While millions of young adults attend public or private nonprofit colleges and universities to continue their education after high school, millions also opt to attend for-profit schools. For-profits often allow flexibility in scheduling and many trade-skill programs. These for-profit schools include well-known names like the University of Phoenix, ITT Technical Institute, and DeVry University. President Obama concluded in 2013 that some of these schools victimized students. They'd been preyed upon very badly by some of these for-profit institutions. He said, "Their credit is ruined, and the for-profit institution is making out like a bandit." Military veterans, he declared, were often manipulated by these schools, which recognized there was a whole bunch of money that the federal government was committed to making sure that our veterans got a good education, and they started advertising to these young people, signing them up, getting them to take a bunch of loans, but they weren't delivering a good product. Defenders of for-profit colleges would say that they are viable gateways to opportunity for many who might not otherwise have access to career development. Their students are often older students, half of whom work full-time. A third are raising their own kids while attending school. Many students like the schools because they provide more convenient locations than traditional schools. Their record for graduation can be superior to nonprofit schools. As one researcher notes, for all their widely publicized shortcomings, for-profits turn out to be better than community colleges at graduating students from two-year programs. The pros and cons, or reasoned logic, was less important than the federal government's leverage. In any given year, these for-profit schools received as much as $32 billion in federal student aid. Government leverage from the Obama administration began in 2011 when the Department of Education announced implementation of a so-called gainful employment rule, which would require for-profit schools to track the performance of their graduates in the job marketplace. Those programs that did not deliver good outcomes would be cut off from federal grants and federally backed student loans. The DOE meetings to craft regulations included names who were now connected with Vistria. According to the Department of Education, Tony Miller, as the Deputy Secretary of Education, participated in those private meetings with for-profit schools. So did Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education. Both would eventually leave DOE for Vistria, Miller taking a position as Chief Operating Officer, Duncan maintaining an office there. While the new regulations had their plausible merits, it quickly became clear that there was money to be made by investors specially attuned to DOE regulatory changes. Emails indicate that senior Department of Education officials were communicating with Wall Street investors about the new regulatory rules. Wall Street hedge funds were buying and selling the stock of for-profit colleges and universities, so details on what the rules said and how and when they would be implemented could make or cost traders a lot of money. The left-leaning Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, obtained emails that indicated senior Department of Education officials were actively communicating with hedge fund investors that were shorting, betting that prices would go down, for-profit college stocks based on the new rules. CREW found that both the Deputy Undersecretary of Education and the Budget Development Staff Director carried out a planned leak of the proposed gainful employment regulations to a number of outside individuals and groups in advance of the regulations' public release. This effort started with an email from hedge fund short seller Stephen Eisman. CREW argued that high-level education officials involved in the agency rulemaking process not only knew of the efforts of certain hedge fund managers to influence the regulatory outcome, but may themselves have colluded with those individuals to protect the short seller's financial interests. They also document a plan by high-level education officials to leak the contents of the gainful employment regulations in advance of their public issuance. Two U.S. senators sent a letter to the Education Inspector General asking for an investigation. The department may have leaked the proposed regulations to parties supporting the administration's position and investors who stand to benefit from the failure of the proprietary school sector. In the U.S. Senate, a diverse group of officials, including Senators Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and Michael Enzi of Wyoming, expressed deep concerns about short sellers trying to game the market based on what the Department of Education would do. The gainful employment rule by the Department of Education was only the beginning of regulatory fire. Soon came a broader series of crackdowns on the industry by agencies including the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Securities and Exchange Commission against for-profit schools. The industry felt they were clearly under the gun. "We've come to expect these unjust assaults," said Gene Feichner, president and chief executive officer of the ITT Technical Institute. "Let there be no presumption here that we believe we'll be treated fairly." Particularly hard hit by the Obama push against for-profit colleges was the Apollo Education Group, which operated the University of Phoenix. The school was well known because it had satellite campuses around the country, advertised regularly, and even sponsored a football stadium for the NFL's Arizona Cardinals. Beyond grappling with the new gainful employment rule, Apollo was forced to play defense by the feds. In July 2015, the Federal Trade Commission announced an investigation into Apollo regarding potential deceptive advertising, sale, or marketing of its services to students. By October, the Department of Defense put the University of Phoenix on probation. On October 7, 2015, Pentagon official Don Bilodeau sent a letter to the University of Phoenix imposing the suspension and specifically cited the large military bases at Fort Bragg, Fort Carson, Fort Hood, and Fort Campbell as being affected. The school had been receiving $2 billion to almost $4 billion a year in taxpayer funds, largely because so many soldiers, sailors, and Marines were attending the school. But that income stream was now under threat. The move against for-profit universities was a dramatic blow to companies, but also to veterans. Unlike students with federal student loans, the GI Bill benefits vanish when the 36-month tuition period runs out. Furthermore, the GI Bill includes housing for school, which means that vets on the GI Bill attending for-profit schools were losing their housing payments. Some actually became homeless as a result. The DOD action against the University of Phoenix was swift and surprising. The school appears to be one of a handful of schools that were singled out. About 15 schools had committed similar offenses, but the Pentagon only suspended four of them. The four suspended were all for-profit schools and included the University of Phoenix. In 2016, Peter Levine, acting Undersecretary of Defense, told a congressional panel that the matter was handled poorly. "I think the process was crappy," he said. But the damage was done. It was a devastating blow to the company. The stock price declined from $11.29 a share in October 2015 to $6.38 by January 2016. The price in January 2016 was off over 90% from where the company's stock was in January 2009 when Obama took office. The story might have ended here, with the company's decline and eventual collapse under government pressure. But then suddenly, riding to the rescue was a group of investors, among whom was President Obama's best friend. That group included the Wall Street firm Apollo Global Management, not previously affiliated with Apollo Education Group, an Arizona-based investment firm called Najafi Companies, and Marty Nesbitt's Vistria Group. Both Apollo Global Management and Najafi Companies are large players in the private equity field. They have large investments around the world. Vistria was a small player in comparison. Only a couple of years old, it was clearly the smallest of the three. What did they bring to the table? Apparently, princeling connections with executive branch approval insurance. Before the sale was finalized, the deal required the approval of the Department of Education, where, of course, Vistria's Miller used to be a senior official. There was also the all-important matter of getting the federal student money flowing again to the University of Phoenix from the Obama administration. Vistria and their partners hired D.C. power attorney Jamie Gorelick, who served as a deputy attorney general in the Clinton administration, to lobby the Pentagon to lift the suspension on federal money, and she did so successfully in January 2016. As Nesbitt and his team of investors awaited Obama administration approval for the deal, he attended White House events, showed up at an intimate Obama birthday party celebration, golfed with him on Martha's Vineyard, attended fundraisers, and they played basketball together. By December 8, 2016, the Obama administration approved the sale of the Apollo Education Group, but there were several conditions. The Department of Education required the company to submit a letter of credit valued at 25% of the federal funding they were expecting to get via student loans and grants. That amounted to about $386 million. It was a condition for approving the sale. Vistria and its co-investors claimed that these demands were excessive and would put the deal at risk. Less than 2 weeks later, on December 20th, just weeks before Obama was to leave office, the Department of Education lowered that credit requirement from 25% to 10%. The other 15% could be put in escrow. On February 8, 2016, the holding company for the University of Phoenix, Apollo Education Group, announced that it was being sold. The transaction was valued at $1.1 billion. Apollo Global Management, Najafi, and Vistria bought it for just $10 a share, or $1.14 billion. It is worth restating that the company, before the regulatory onslaught during Obama's tenure, had been worth almost nine times that price. With the sale, Tony Miller became the chairman of the board. Miller, of course, had been the number two official in the Department of Education when the campaign against for-profit colleges had been launched, and a participant in those pivotal meetings. Arnie Duncan set up an office at Vistria's headquarters in Chicago, overlooking Chicago's Millennium Park. So, Obama's best friend and senior officials in his administration gained control of a for-profit college in a bargain deal. Better yet for Vistria, competitors were smashed and were now out of business. Corinthian Colleges Incorporated was run out of business. Arnie Duncan, then still the Secretary of Education, explained in 2015 that he was thrilled to be able to close down Corinthian. ITT was essentially shut down, eliminating almost all of their 8,000 jobs and leaving tens of thousands of students stranded without a school or a degree. Those in the world of education took notice. "I think every way you look at this transaction is questionable and suspicious," said Diane Jones, former Assistant Secretary for Post-Secondary Education at the Department of Education under President George W. Bush. Jones allowed that the DOE's changing terms after a public recommendation is highly unusual. "There is at least a taste of unseemliness involved in this," said Mark Schneider, a senior education official during George W. Bush's presidency. "They regulate it. They drive the price down. They are buying it for pennies on the dollar." Congressman Virginia Fox, who heads the House Committee on Education and the Workforce's Subcommittee on Higher Education, said, "It's ironic that a former senior official at the Department of Education, an agency that has intentionally targeted and sought to dismantle the for-profit college industry, would now take the reins at the country's largest for-profit college. I contacted Nesbitt, Vistria, and others about this deal, but they failed to respond. Former Education Secretary Duncan got back to me and said that there was no favoritism in this deal." Nesbitt was not the only princeling ready to grab from the spoils in the for-profit college space. One investment fund that was aggressively buying and selling stocks in for-profit colleges as valuations fluctuated in the wake of Obama's push was called Ariel Investments. It is run by John Rogers, who, like Marty Nesbitt, is a close Obama friend. He is also best friends with Michelle Obama's brother, Craig Robinson. Rogers was one of Barack Obama's earliest financial supporters when he ran for the state Senate back in Illinois. Rogers was also part of the Chicago Circle, who traveled and socialized with Obama. By 2016, he had already donated between $500,000 to $750,000 to the Obama Foundation. Throughout the Obama administration, Ariel was actively buying and selling shares in a number of for-profit schools. In late 2010, Ariel held $121 million worth of shares in DeVry, which operates training schools around the country. They also held a small $4.63 million in Apollo Education. But by early 2011, their position in DeVry had increased to $215 million, 3.91 million shares, and their stake in Apollo Education had jumped to $33 million, 802,945 shares. Their investment in DeVry represented their second largest position at the fund. By mid-2011, they had cut their position in DeVry by close to 25%. These sales of stock coincide with when Senator Charles Grassley and others in Washington began looking at whether the Department of Education officials were leaking confidential government information to hedge fund managers. Ariel continued to trade in the stocks of for-profit colleges throughout the Obama years. After Secretary of Education Arne Duncan resigned his post effective January 1, 2016, besides establishing an office at Vistria, he also joined the board of directors of Ariel Investments. Another of the highly regulated sectors Marty Nesbitt's Vistria moved into following in the wake of an Obama administration regulatory push was the financial industry. Recall that Vistria had hired John Samuels, an aide to President Obama who had helped push through the financial reform bill known as Dodd-Frank. The new law, which was signed by Barack Obama in July 2010, created a new cluster of regulations that affected virtually every aspect of the U.S. financial industry and gave the federal government broad regulatory powers over financial industries that had previously been regulated mostly at the state level. One of the hardest hit was the cash advance industry, which provided short-term loans to individuals and businesses. Plenty of abuses had taken place in the industry, but many have argued that these lenders play an important role in the financial lives of millions of Americans, whether they be business owners or individuals. According to the 2011 FDIC, or Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, National Survey of Unbanked and Underbanked Households, more than 33 million households were unbanked, no accounts whatsoever, or underbanked, accessed alternative financial services like payday lending, primarily because banks don't issue credit to people with high credit risk. So cash advance businesses played an important role in the economy by providing cash to people who might need it for short periods of time, but who couldn't qualify for a traditional loan. Economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York also challenged the notion that cash advance companies were that bad, arguing that most of the critique was exaggerated. Many elements of the payday lending critique, their unconscionable and spiraling fees and their targeting of minorities, don't hold up under scrutiny and the weight of evidence, they wrote. Regardless of where one falls on the issue, there can be no debate about what followed. In July 2011, as a result of the new law, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or CFPB, opened its doors. The new federal government regulatory agency had a dual mission: educating Americans on financial matters and also investigating what it regarded as unfair lending practices, particularly by the consumer finance industry. By December 2012, the Obama Department of Justice was teaming up with the CFPB team to crack down on what it deemed to be financial crimes. The fair lending enforcement work of the CFPB and the Justice Department is part of efforts underway by the Financial Fraud Enforcement Task Force, or FFETF, which was created to wage an aggressive, coordinated, and proactive effort to investigate and prosecute financial crimes. The CFPB and the department's Civil Rights Division are among the co-chairs of the FFETF's Non-Discrimination Working Group. Beginning in 2013, the Department of Justice and the CFPB would begin to aggressively investigate, audit, and generally harass payday and small loan lenders. The creation of the new government agency almost immediately caused waves in the industry. According to the 2012 SEC filings for First Cash Financial Services, Incorporated, the CFPB could make the continuance of all or part of the company's current U.S. business impractical or unprofitable. Other lenders shared similar warnings. Within the cash advance industry, it was widely believed that the new regulations would lead to heavy burdens for smaller lenders. A report done by the Heritage Foundation estimated that the new regulations would throw many lenders out of business, stating that the new regulatory strictures will reduce consumers' choices of financial products and services. This would then winnow out the competition and create opportunities for other firms to acquire them. Operation Choke Point was launched by the U.S. Department of Justice in 2013 and targeted banks and the business they do with payday lenders, payment processors, and other financial companies they believed to be at higher risk for fraud and money laundering. The government was reportedly pressuring the financial industry to cut off the access to banking services, including access to capital or loans. Banks terminated their accounts with payday lenders because of the federal scrutiny. A lawsuit claimed numerous check cashers and payday lenders had their relationships terminated because of the policy. As one executive in the industry put it to an industry publication in 2016, some lenders were being squeezed out of the business by regulations like Operation Choke Point. At a House Financial Services Committee on April 8, 2014, it was argued that Operation Choke Point was hurting non-bank financial service providers by reducing their access to the banking system. The effect on the industry was clear. The number of financial institutions offering these loans began to shrink. Regular banks, which actually offered cash advances more than one might think, got out of the business in response to guidance from other regulators. There began what the Washington Post called serious retrenchment in the industry. The closing of some businesses, of course, created opportunities for other lenders who were able to adapt to the new rules. One of those businesses that thrived in the wake of the new rules was a small lender based out of California called Forward Line Financial. The company had some well-connected friends. In October 2015, Forward Line Financial announced that it had a new chairman, none other than President Obama's best friend, Marty Nesbitt. Also joining the board was Vistria associate Michael Castelforte. Forward Line was founded in 2003 and was designed to provide alternative financing solutions to small businesses and as a provider of small business merchant loans and cash advances. Forward Line uses non-traditional credit algorithms to finance 98% of U.S. businesses that banks consider too small and too risky for a business loan. Forward Line's business interests were directly affected by Dodd-Frank legislation. As Forward Line's competitors were choked out of the finance industry by mechanisms like the CFPB and the DOJ's Operation Choke Point, Forward Line actually saw its business grow. One of Forward Line's competitors, Advance America Cash Advance Centers, Incorporated, sued the federal government, charging that they were being targeted in such a way that they could not get banks to work with them, alleging they were the object of regulatory retaliation. Forward Line has critics who argue that the company engages in some of the industry's worst practices. They accuse the company of charging excessive interest rates. One man who got a $33,000 business loan claims that he was given a one-month loan at a 30% interest rate. Others, including consumer evaluators, complain that the company is not transparent about interest rates and fees. Princeling Marty Nesbitt also enjoyed other boons, arguably based on his blood-like ties to the president, in the form of corporate board appointments from major corporations that faced serious regulatory challenges from the Obama administration. He joined the boards of several companies in industries for which he had no background or history. From the earliest days, the railway industry was feeling the regulatory heat of the Obama administration. Back in 1980, Congress sent, and President Jimmy Carter signed, the Staggers Rail Act, which largely but not completely deregulated the U.S. freight rail industry. That had essentially been the consensus point of American politics until the Obama administration announced its intentions to re-regulate the industry. The Obama administration was consistently pushing for new taxes and regulations on the industry. With Obama's re-election in 2012, the railroad industry was on notice that they faced the prospects of re-regulation after more than 30 years. As Norfolk Southern Railroad put it in its 2012 annual report, 10-K filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, efforts have been made over the past several years to resubject the rail industry to increased federal economic regulation, and such efforts are expected to continue in 2013. Accordingly, we will continue to oppose efforts to reimpose increased economic regulation. The Obama administration regularly proposed new freight rail regulations to Congress. Further, the Obama administration's Surface Transportation Board, or STB, became a wholly independent federal agency during his tenure. Along with the Federal Railroad Administration, or FRA, the STB had widespread regulatory control over railroads' environmental, safety, and security. They determined rates, routes, fuel surcharges, conditions of service, and the extension or abandonment of rail lines. Together, they also had jurisdiction over the consolidation, merger, or acquisition of control of and by rail common carriers, and regulate certain track and mechanical equipment standards. Weeks after President Obama was re-elected and sworn in for a second term, Norfolk Southern announced that Marty Nesbitt was joining their corporate board. Nesbitt had no background in railroads or transportation, unless you count airport parking garages as transportation. His 2015 compensation was $278,937. Another company facing aggressive regulatory problems with the Obama administration was American Airlines. Just as Marty Nesbitt was joining the Norfolk Southern board, American Airlines was in serious financial trouble. Facing bankruptcy and even possible financial collapse, American announced a merger with U.S. Airways. But the Obama Justice Department immediately filed suit to stop it on the grounds that the merger was anti-competitive. Members of Congress soon stepped in to offer their support for the merger. 65 Democratic congressmen and congresswomen signed a letter in support of American. The letter, addressed to President Barack Obama, stated, "We believe DOJ's legal challenge puts at risk the future economic security of our constituents, tens of thousands of unionized workers at both airlines, and the economic well-being of communities that we represent. We are concerned that the DOJ's lawsuit creates an atmosphere of uncertainty for our respective congressional districts and constituents. While we share your concern regarding any potential impact on consumers as consolidation in any industry is contemplated, we believe that DOJ's concerns as outlined in the complaint filed last month are not an adequate representation of all of the facts." In light of the congressional pushback, the Obama administration backed down from blocking the merger. But American Airlines' struggle with the Obama White House continued. The company had serious pension problems and was embroiled in a struggle with the federal government's Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. There was also a federal investigation launched by the Obama administration into alleged price gouging. The investigation was announced in July 2015. Additionally, American Airlines was pressing the Obama administration to renegotiate the so-called Open Skies Agreement, which they argued created unfair competition. By October 2015, U.S. News was reporting that American, as well as two other big carriers, were lobbying to shield us from competition and roll back consumer protections. American Airlines emerged as a leading voice in the bumpy campaign to persuade the White House to intervene in what it calls unfair competition from foreign rivals. They argued that the governments in certain countries were funneling billions of dollars into subsidies for their airlines, creating an unfair advantage. In September 2015, the CEO of American Airlines met with Secretary